Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
Now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage. Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
I have determined that it is in our vital national interest to send an additional 30,000 U.S. troops to Afghanistan.
I've committed more than 20,000 additional American troops to Iraq.
In Afghanistan, we and our allies prevented the Taliban from stopping a presidential election.
The elections of 2005 were a stunning achievement.
I insisted on a thorough review of our strategy.
It is clear that we need to change our strategy in Iraq.
As your commander-in-chief, I owe you a mission that is clearly defined.
Our troops will have a well-defined mission.
30,000 U.S. troops.
20,000 additional American troops.
Presidential election.
The elections of 2005.
Strategy.
Strategy.
Clearly defined.
Well-defined mission.
This is Michael Savage. As I watched President Stooge Bama last night reading a puppeteer's script, I was actually saddened. I was depressed. In fact, I went home from the studio and had a couple of drinks because I realized that he's not running the country. I mean, we knew that from the beginning, but it's the same military-industrial complex that has been running America off the rails for a long time now that's still running America off the rails right now. Not only were there direct parallels between him and Bush, but there were direct parallels between Obama and Lyndon Baines Johnson in his speech to the nation on the night of March 31st, 1968. That's right. That's how far back this warmongering goes. Now, you know what happened in Vietnam. And I'm telling you as I sit here, I heard Obama's speech before, in part, when Bush gave it. I heard Obama's speech before when LBJ gave it in 1968. And I hope to God that I am wrong. I pray to God that I am wrong, but in my heart of hearts, I fear I'm right. And I see the same end as Vietnam here. You don't announce to an enemy your exit strategy and when you're leaving. They'll just wait it out. You don't say to the troops, they're wonderful people, and you don't say, we know you're going to win and on to victory. Not once did the word win come into Obama's speech. The word win was not spoken either by Obama, nor by Lyndon Baines Johnson. Also, the parallels became increasingly obvious when he said, tonight, I want the Afghan people to understand America seeks an end to this era of war and suffering. See, Johnson had said, let men everywhere know that a strong and confident and a vigilant America stands ready tonight to seek an honorable peace. It gets worse by the second. Listen to 25 and 26. You're not going to believe what you're hearing.
So tonight, I want the Afghan people to understand. America seeks an end to this era of war and suffering.
Let men everywhere know, however, that a strong and a confident and a vigilant America stands ready tonight to seek an honorable peace.
Okay. Listen to 29 and 30 now.
Now, the people of Afghanistan have endured violence for decades. They've been confronted with occupation by the Soviet Union and then by foreign al-Qaeda fighters who used Afghan land for their own purposes.
That small, beleaguered nation has suffered terrible punishment for more than 20 years. I pay tribute once again tonight to the great courage and the endurance of its people.
Okay, so there we have Afghanistan and Vietnam in comparison. And again, in 31 and 32, listen to the eerie similarities.
We will seek a partnership with Afghanistan grounded in mutual respect. to isolate those who destroy, to strengthen those who build, to hasten the day when our troops will leave, and to forge a lasting friendship in which America is your partner and never your patron.
Over time, a wider framework of peace and security in Southeast Asia may become possible. The new cooperation of the nations of the area could be a foundation stone. Certainly, friendship with the nations of such a Southeast Asia is what the United States seeks.
And now listen to what we've got for you now in the Savage Nation in 33 and 34.
In the end, our security and leadership does not come solely from the strength of our arms. It derives from our people.
The ultimate strength of our country and our cause will lie not in powerful weapons or infinite resources or boundless wealth, but will lie in the unity of our people.
Now, listening to LBJ, you know why so many people turn to marijuana and other drugs. You literally feel as though he himself is speaking while on glue. But putting the comedic aside, this is not comedy, this is tragedy. It may as well be the same cast of characters that ran America off the rails during the Vietnam War all over again. Instead of whoever the defense secretary is today, I think it's Gates, we had a despicable creature as defense secretary under LBJ named McNamara. Same exact mentality. No win, just peace and friendship. Not from the barrel of a gun, but from the barrel of a beer or something like that. We're going to be all friends. And that's why we lost in Vietnam, because we didn't use the barrel of a gun. We used instead this rubbish about peace with the Vietnamese. Now, if we haven't learned from our defeat in Vietnam, which apparently we have not learned, how in heck do you think we could possibly do anything that is successful, vaguely, remotely help me here, successful in Afghanistan? I am not the only one here. I may be an independent conservative who tends to the right side of things, which is true, but there are those on the left who are rational, whose politics I don't agree with, but they're rational. They're not irrational leftist psychos. They're not from ACT UP or whatever those groups are called, whatever those groups are. I don't even remember the madness of these groups. But Feingold is a mainstream leftist who himself, in clips 35, in 35, tells you what he thinks of Obama's speech. Listen.
The president says we're doing this, we're adding 30, 35,000 troops to finish the job. And I ask the question, what job? Because the president has been so eloquent in pointing out that our issue is fighting Al-Qaeda. The argument falls apart when you realize that Al-Qaeda does not have its headquarters in Afghanistan anymore. It is headquartered in Pakistan. It is active in Somalia, in Yemen, North Africa, affiliates of it in Southeast Asia. Why does it make sense to have a huge ground presence in Afghanistan to deal with a small Al-Qaeda contingent when we don't do that in so many other countries where we're actually having some success without invading the country and attacking those that are part of Al-Qaeda? It doesn't make sense.
And Feingold, Senator Russ Feingold, said he will vote against funding President Obama's Afghanistan plan, which is pretty amazing. And he's actually going to put his vote where his rhetoric is, which is very unusual in political circles. Now, in 36, he spells it out even more clearly, his discontent with Obama. Listen to that one.
There's no sense at all of how long we'll stay there. The withdrawal doesn't even begin for a year and a half, and then there's absolutely no commitment to finishing the withdrawal. It simply says we'll begin a withdrawal. So, it's nice to hear the word, the notion that we might not be staying there forever. But there's no meat on the bones. And so that troubles me a great deal. You have this huge surge of troop buildup without any clear exit strategy. And my question is, what are we going to accomplish with all the human sacrifice and economic sacrifice in the next 3 years that is going to be much better than what we have now? I'm extremely skeptical, and it will not help us in any significant way in the worldwide struggle against Al-Qaeda.
Well, you heard it both from the right and the left. Obama has failed miserably. But let's go back to my opening for a minute. My montage comparing Obama to Bush, I think, says it all. But I then went on to show you the comparisons between Obama and Lyndon Baines Johnson in his March 31, 1968 exit strategy in Vietnam speech. Both pledged to end the war, not to win it. The word win wasn't spoken in either speech. The word victory was not mentioned in Obama's. Obama said, tonight I want the Afghan people to understand America seeks an end to this era of war and suffering. And what did Johnson say back in 68? Let men everywhere know that a strong, a confident, and a vigilant America stands ready tonight to seek an honorable peace. So what they're talking about is the same thing. And what I'm afraid of is the same ending. I'll be right back.
Some writers and critics who prophesize with your pen and keep your eyes wide, the chance won't come again. And don't speak too soon, for the wheel's still in spin. And there's no telling who that it's naming. For the loser now will be later to win. For the times, they are a-changing.
It's sad. Let me tell you something. What do you think? I'm taking pleasure in knocking Obama. I mean, the fact of the matter is the guy looked like a puppet on a string last night. It was pathetic to watch, number one. And you saw at the end of the day that with all of the talk about him being a Marxist and a left, it's all rubbish. He is the stooge of the international bankers. Write it down, set it in stone, challenge me on it. I can guarantee you that certain investment banks have their tentacles into some of the defense industries that are going to profit in the trillions from this continued war in Afghanistan. You can guarantee yourself one thing, that when I played Eisenhower's famous Beware the Military-Industrial Complex speech, not only yesterday but years ago, I played it over and over again because I found it and kept playing it, nothing has changed. There is no reason to be in Afghanistan, as far as I could tell. So far, I haven't seen a compelling argument. I certainly didn't hear it last night. I keep hearing that if we get out of Afghanistan, the enemy will move into the vacuum and they'll have a huge victory. Well, wait a minute. That's sort of the domino theory that we heard in Vietnam as well. Put that down to something I've heard before as well, that unless we defeat the North Vietnamese, we're going to see a domino effect of communism in Asia. Well, there has been a domino effect of communism in Asia. And guess what? China's a communist-slash-capitalist state that has overtaken the United States of America. And that's after 50-some-odd thousand men were killed, and hundreds of thousands of men came back maimed or psychologically damaged, and the country was torn in half by the very same corporate minds in military uniforms who defeated us in Vietnam, and the very same corporate minds in military uniforms today who are going to defeat us in Afghanistan and destroy this country's honors and traditions. Mark it down, write it down, spread it around. This is the Savage Nation. That's my viewpoint. What's your viewpoint is the issue. Let's go to Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Mike, you're up on the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Dr. Savage, I listened to that speech last night, and I almost began to weep because I know some of those men and women that were sitting in those seats. And then I heard Chris Matthews' comment on softball when he referred to the troops as the enemy camp, and I got very angry.
Chris Matthews is insane. In my opinion, the man should be taken off the air. I've said this before. He talked about killing Rush Limbaugh. He says things that are beyond belief just for effect, without understanding that people are actually listening. But remember who he works for. He works for Immelt, who owns General Electric, who owns NBC and MSNBC. Immelt is going to profit in the trillions by this war, as sure as I'm standing here.
Dr. Savage, I've known some of those boys since they were virtually babies, 13, 14 years old.
These are children. You're talking about the boys at West Point?
But these are the boys who could have walked into Harvard and Yale and Princeton. They could have.
That's right, but most of them are nice, naive young men who are awed by the word president. He did not give the speech at the National War College, did he?
No,
he did not give the speech to the men who are actually going to have to be in the field fighting the war, meaning the leadership of the military. He gave it to the, let us say, to the interns in the military. The cadets at West Point are military interns, after all. That's who he gave it to, where he knew he would have a crowd of loving, idolizing young men. That's what he gave it to, with a smattering of a few women in there. That's what it was all about. But let's put aside the visuals of the West Point. His plan itself is a plan of defeatism, is it not?
Yes, absolutely. And the reason he was getting the stink eye from these kids were the fact that these are all educated kids. These are all kids who graduate. Every kid that I put at West Point or in the Air Force Academy or in Annapolis graduated with an above 4.0 GPA. They were taking accelerated classes. They were the best and the brightest that our school had. And they know.
Well, let me tell you something. The mountain canyons of the foothills of the Himalayas which, as you well know, are where the mountains of Afghanistan are. The mountains of Afghanistan are the foothills of the Himalayas. You know that as well, don't you?
The Tora Bora are a fortress.
Yes, and those canyons and those valleys suck entire regiments that are never seen again. These guys grew up in those mountains. Do we have enough 10th Mountain Divisions to fight there? You need the equivalent of a highly trained 10th Mountain Division to the scale of 100-fold in order to go in there properly. You cannot take ordinarily trained men and put them into this kind of terrain and expect them to win. That's another point that we're not talking about. Do we have enough men trained in mountain warfare to go in there?
No, Dr. Savage, these people are not even intelligent enough to know that the Afghani tribal people and the Pakistani people, if you go back in the history, they are the same people. They are the Pushtun, who lived in the Tora Bora for centuries. They know every nook, every cranny, and while he's been sitting around giving us the double talk, they've been reinforcing and booby-trapping and set up ambush points. This guy is a dope.
Well, I don't blame him. I blame the generals who told him to go ahead with it, because they don't answer to themselves either. Remember who the leadership in the military work for. They work for the military-industrial complex. They wouldn't have gotten their job if they didn't. Don't you see what I'm saying here?
Absolutely. It's the exact same thing that
Well, that's why I was saddened last night. I didn't take any pleasure in listening to Obama look like a dunce or a puppet on a string. It didn't make me happy. It made me sad. But what made me even angrier was watching the liberal vermin in the media immediately thereafter supporting his plan. The very same left-wing rats who were anti-war all through Bush's regime are now suddenly gung-ho militarists because their master, their ruler, their hero, their emperor, Obama, said war is necessary. And then all of a sudden the empty suits and the empty skirts started to say, well, I guess it's necessary. I wanted to scream at the television. I couldn't believe the grotesqueness of it. People who had never shot a Daisy BB gun in their lives, left-wing fanatics, red through and through, are suddenly military experts and are all in favor of your son dying.
Savage.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
I have determined that it is in our vital national interest to send an additional 30,000 U.S. troops to Afghanistan.
I've committed more than 20,000 additional American troops to Iraq.
In Afghanistan, we and our allies prevented the Taliban from stopping a presidential election.
The elections of 2005 were a stunning achievement.
I insisted on a thorough review of our strategy.
It is clear that we need to change our strategy in Iraq.
As your commander-in-chief, I owe you a mission that is clearly defined.
Our troops will have a well-defined mission.
30,000 U.S. troops.
20,000 additional American troops.
Presidential election.
The elections of 2005.
Strategy.
Strategy.
Clearly defined.
Well-defined mission.
Look, I have the best research team in the history of talk radio. And when I said, see if you can find the LBJ speech, the Bush speeches that are eerily remind me of what Obama said last night, because Obama looked like a puppet on a string. Everybody knows that. Even the liberal worshipers were saying he had no verve, no commitment. He was lackluster. In other words, limp-wristed. Was that your idea of leadership? If you were a soldier who had to go out and risk your life, would you feel that your commander-in-chief, in the form of a radical leftist peacenik who has never fired a Daisy BB gun, is the correct commander-in-chief for a war of this nature? I don't think so. Rodney in Sacramento, thanks for calling. You're up on the Savage Nation. Topic, please.
Yeah, Michael, I'm optimistic about last night's speech. And the reason that I'm optimistic is he said that he gave a time that he's going to give out, and that'll give him time to arm that Afghani army. And once they're armed, they're on their own. We're out of there. And furthermore, you currently got Iran surrounded with troops in Afghanistan and Iraq, both on the left and the right. That means they're surrounded. And when the time comes for them, if they don't change course, they will cut off their route of escape. There will be no place to go but right into our hands.
Well, the first statement you made needs to be analyzed. everyone is criticizing him signaling an exit strategy and an exit date, except you. Don't you think that if you were the enemy, you would wait for that date in order to bring in your heavy arms, your heavy equipment, your heavy attacks?
That's the estimated time that it's going to take to get the Afghanis up and running on their own steam.
Now, what evidence do you have, if any, that the Afghanis could ever do this?
The only evidence that I have is a financial commitment. Once that financial commitment is surpassed what it already is, which we're already surpassed our financial commitment to that area of the world, that's as far as they're willing to go. So in a year and a half, if they can't bring up that Afghani army so they can run on their own steam, Michael, then we're out of there. He's telling them, you guys are going to have to.
Well, but look, I don't know your age bracket, but you certainly are a reasonable person. We heard the same nonsense with regard to the South Vietnamese, that they would be up and running and be able to take on the North Vietnamese. They never were able to, even though there were some phenomenally brave and competent South Vietnamese Army officers and Air Force pilots. And I happen to know one who flew jets for the South Vietnamese, a wonderful man. They were never able to face the North Vietnamese. So I don't believe that the Afghanis are ever going to be able to do it personally by history, number one. And number two, I don't trust any of them. In fact, I distrust all of them. Every one of them is capable of undermining our troops and killing them by shooting them in the back. Who all of a sudden would believe that the Afghanis are on our side?
They're a bunch of criminals, there's no doubt about it. But we've been there for 8 years, Michael, and you know that's he's telling you that we're getting out of there. Either they step up to the plate and do the best that they can, or otherwise we're out of there. And meanwhile, don't forget, we got Iran surrounded. That would tickle George Patton to death, starting off with an enemy that's currently surrounded.
Now, did you vote for Barack Obama?
I'm a Democrat from way back. I voted Clinton, Gore, and then it was Kerry, and then I voted against Obama, and then I voted for John, supposed Maverick McShane, and now the supposedly rogue Palin, you know, she's trying to do, you know, they try to come off as something that they're not, they're different or whatever, they're all the
yes.
same.
So now you're a cynic. At the end of the day, you're a realist on one hand and a cynic on the other. You said something very telling just now, Rodney. You said they're all the same. That is, after they get elected, they're all the same. Didn't Obama's speech indicate to you that the words you just said are true? In other words, he was running as a peacenik, leftist, end-the-war candidate. Now the first thing he does in a major policy speech is say, I'm going to extend the war by ramping up the number of troops, 30,000 more. Rodney, I'm afraid that he's not making these decisions at all. I think they're being made for him.
I wouldn't doubt that at all. I mean, he's got all the cabinet, you know, that's advising him and what have you. And, you know, the fact of the matter is they've been over there for 8 years, Mike, and he's telling you we're getting out, we're going to bring up those Afghanis.
Well, he actually didn't say we're getting out. He said we're going to, if you listen carefully, he said, and this is interesting, he said we're going to begin the withdrawal in that particular time, 2011, was it? I don't know exactly when. He didn't say how many men he would withdraw. He could withdraw one man in 2011 and then say we're canceling the withdrawal. My friend, Rodney, I believe we're going to face a 50-year war because, as I said on my show yesterday, let's face it, the problem is not Obama. The problem is our enemy. The enemy is the radical Islamic movement worldwide. Do we agree on that, Rodney?
I totally agree, Michael. If I could say one last thing, the time that our troops have spent on the ground over there fighting with both hands tied behind our back has brought it an intelligence that no other standing army in the world can come start on the ground fighting immediately with what these guys have learned in the field. I'd say each one of our guys is worth 20 of theirs.
Well, I think that each one of our guys has to be worth 10,000 of theirs when you consider the numbers of enemy. They're quite numerous, and they're all over the world. They're not just in Afghanistan. How are you going to fight al-Qaeda in Africa, for example? Are we going to send more troops there?
No. I hope we bring them all back home, and, you know, we need to focus on America. I don't know where this world police cop thing ever started from.
I don't either. I would say we should put our military on the border with Mexico to start with, wouldn't you? Think that would be a better expenditure of military dollars?
100%.
Well, all right, so we can go away friends, Rodney, rather than anger each other. Thanks for that call. I believe that Obama read a speech that at the end of the day satisfied nobody because his heart wasn't in it. There's no question about it. Chicago, Illinois. Fred, welcome. You're on the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, you wrote a book saying that liberalism is a mental disease, and yet you've just vindicated everything they've said for the past decades since Vietnam. Everything you said is what the liberals have been saying for decades. This war.
So in other words, what? What are the liberals saying now, Fred, that makes them so brilliant?
What are they saying now? Well, so far as everything that you've said so far. And everything that you
Fred, please, you know, you're speaking in code words. What are liberals saying about Afghanistan now that you agree with so we can understand what you're saying?
We should get out. That's what they're saying.
Just we should get out. So why did Obama say we should get in?
Huh?
You heard me. Don't suddenly go half deaf on me. You just said liberals said we should get out. Obama said we should get in. So is he not a liberal?
I don't know if he's a liberal. I'm telling you what the liberal movement, the people who voted him in, wanted to get out of the war. That was one of the primary reasons we voted him in. The fact that he's turned his back on them, that's not unusual for any politician.
So how would the liberals, since you consider yourself one of them, and that's fine by me as long as you're willing to discuss your viewpoint, how would you face off a radical Islamic enemy that will not compromise, that will either kill you or convert you? How would you deal with them?
Well, the only way we could deal with them is to defend ourselves against them, which doesn't necessarily mean war. The thing is to step up our home, the things we've already done, step up our home defense, make sure our airports and everything is, are guarded. How can you stop an idea? You can't stop it with a bullet. They're determined to kill us. The only thing you can do is defend yourself any way you can.
But let me ask you, Fred, rationally, do you think there is an Islamic a militant Islamic threat against this country and against the West?
Oh, yeah, there is. There is terrible, hard feelings against us by radical Islamist groups. Yeah, they hate us.
Okay, so your idea is to withdraw the military and face them here through the FBI, through Homeland Security, but not to go to war with them anywhere.
If I thought the war would work, I would go to war. But it's like you said, it doesn't seem to be that a war is going to work. If you could show me where a war works.
Well, it's interesting to me that that leftists like yourself actually agree with me on this, which is not unexpected, because I predicted a few months ago that there would be an anti-war movement in America, but I also said it would be led by the right rather than the left, because it was the right now for quite a while that's been saying no to this war. It doesn't matter who began it, who ended it. What matters is that the military-industrial complex is behind it. I think we could agree on that as well, Fred, correct?
You bet. It is. It is. I agree with you.
Well, all right. All I can say is, Fred, I appreciate you listening so carefully. I disagree with you on some points, on others we agree. Now, this is very intriguing, ladies and gentlemen. Something just happened on this radio show that is historic in the history of radio. And I knew this day would come. I knew the day would come when the two ends of the political spectrum would suddenly see that they're saying the same thing on so many issues. Now, let's start with the most important issue there is, and that's life and death. Life and death issues are what we're talking about. This is not about making points on Obama, making points against Republicans, making points against liberals, or making points against conservatives. It is your neighbor's son who is going to go over there and be butchered to death in Afghanistan if he's caught by these animals. Let's make no mistake about it. What they did to the Russians, you still don't know. You still don't know what they did to the Russian boys that they caught, the 18-year-old blonde boys with blue eyes, the kind of tortures that they were subjected to. You're dealing with medieval throwbacks. They do not respect the Geneva Convention. They do not respect any convention. They respect only one thing, and that's a bullet. And they have a lot of them. They're being supplied by Iran and God knows who else. We have heavy equipment. We have heavy weapons such as the Air Force, missiles. We're not going to use them. So already strategically they have the advantage because they know the terrain. Let me repeat that. You don't have to be an armchair general to understand that I just made eminently good sense. What is our military advantage in? It's in hardware. It's in technology. So if you can't use the hardware and the technology in the form of cruise missiles, in the form of bunker-busting bombs, in the form of F-18 Hornets and the best trained pilots in the world, we have eight or nine aircraft carriers. I was aboard one 2 years ago. Doesn't make me an expert. I was impressed to find out that every one of our aircraft carriers has an air force on it larger than most nations on Earth. I didn't know that. In other words, the strike capacity of any aircraft carrier that the U.S. has is more powerful than the air force of most nations on Earth, single aircraft carrier. And we have them all over the world. Yet we will not be using our aircraft carriers in Afghanistan, will we? Now, why? Well, the why is the interesting part. Again, I want you to go back to geography. You know what the Himalayas are. You heard of Mount Everest, the highest mountain on Earth. The foothills of the Himalayas happen to begin on that side of the Earth in Afghanistan. They slowly climb up to those cloud levels in India. So how are our men going to fight in these deep canyons that have sucked entire brigades that have never been seen again? Russian brigades have gone in there and never came out of these mountain passes. Do I have to tell you about the Khyber Pass? Shall we read some poetry from the British colonial days? Look, you don't have to be a genius to understand this is not a flat plain war where you can enlist 1,000 tanks. It's a different form of warfare. That is why the enemy is so deeply rooted in that area. So that leaves us with very few options other than to put boots on the ground, so to speak. Although I don't like that phrase, it's not boots on the ground. It's Mrs. Smith's son on the ground. Do we have enough men trained in mountain warfare to go out there? He may say 30,000 men. Well, how many of those 30,000 men are trained in high-altitude fighting? How many of those men are as endurance-capable as the enemy who grew up in those mountains? We didn't hear any of that. I doubt that we will. So why are we in Afghanistan? Why are we in Afghanistan? I've been asking the question for a long time now. I don't have the answer for you. I keep hearing that if we don't defeat them there, it's going to create a vacuum into which Al-Qaeda and the other terrorist organizations will have a war cry. They'll come from around the world, and they will have a home base. Well, maybe that is true, but maybe that wouldn't be such a bad idea. Now, why do I say that? Because if they would all coalesce in Afghanistan, at least we could enlist our air force, our cruise missiles. We could unleash the arsenal that we have on all of the terrorists on Earth when they go to celebrate in their new homeland of Afghanistan. So I don't know that this policy is going to work to the detriment of Al-Qaeda. I think, in fact, it's going to encourage Al-Qaeda to keep sucking our young men into the meat grinder. I'll be right back.
How many roads must a man walk down before you call him a man? How many seas must the white dove sail before she sleeps in the sand?
What goes around comes around. We're back where we started from. It's as though the leadership has learned nothing from Vietnam. To me, it was very sad watching, listening to Obama last night. Not only did he look, you know, he may be a political opponent to me, and he is, but he's still a human being. And there's a part of me that's very compassionate for human beings. I don't care whether you agree with, listen, believe me or not, doesn't matter. I know what my heart says. My heart is open, my heart is pure, and I'll tell you, I felt bad for him last night. The man looked like a puppet. He looked defeated to me. The man gave two speeches in one. It was false. The fact of the matter is he left both the left and the right distraught. The fact of the matter is he became his own worst enemy by compromising so badly last night. First there'd be a surge, then a withdrawal. First we'd march in, then we would march out. Troops center from the right, and then they exit to the left. Nothing made sense. It was as though he took a speech from George Bush. First he says extremists kill in the name of Islam, and then adds immediately it is one of the world's great religions. He says that the responsibility for the country's security would soon be transferred to the government of Karzai, a government which he said was corrupt. The Taliban is dangerous and growing stronger, but, quote, America will have to show our strength in the way that we end wars. Nothing made sense. It was a classic schizophrenic speech of a politician. It frankly was not magical. He has lost his magic. This was a speech that left everybody limp and distraught. The fact of the matter is the cadets who were gathered at West Point were told by the leadership, the military leadership, to respond enthusiastically to the speech. They were instructed to respond enthusiastically to the speech. But if you actually watch the faces of these young guys, their reception was anything but enthusiastic. It was cool. Why do you think that that was so? Well, you don't have to be a cadet at West Point to have understood why some of these young men became nauseous upon hearing Obama's speech. It was packed with rhetoric. It was, in other words, filled with lies. The man spoke of responsibility, but it really sounded like a party speech. He demanded sacrifice from them, not from himself, not from the fat cats in the U.S. Congress. Again, I raise a question. Can anyone answer this question? How many members of Congress have children who are in the military? Can you name one who has an active combat child in the military? Don't tell me they have a lawyer at Quantico trying our troops. I don't want to hear it. Tell me which members of Congress have a single child in a combat situation. Fact of the matter is the speech was filled with vanity. And it was dizzying. It was very dizzying. The public was disturbed by it. Nobody was entertained by it. Nobody felt good from it. Everyone felt bad from it. The fact of the matter is, I don't think he knows what to do. I think he was lost. So that leaves the question to you, the people. Do I know what to do? Am I lost? Do I have a clear answer to this problem? Would I know what to do if the responsibility fell on my shoulder? It's very easy to sit here and say he didn't know what he was talking about, but I do. Now, in many cases, I feel that I know more than leaders do on certain issues. And I felt that for a long time, and I've given you opinions on borders, language, and culture. But when it comes to this one, I must tell you that I don't have a clear answer. My instincts are to get out of there. But do I mean tomorrow? Do I mean overnight? And what punishing lesson do we leave the enemy? I don't have an answer to that, do you? I'll be right back.
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
I have determined that it is in our vital national interest to send an additional 30,000 U.S. troops to Afghanistan.
I've committed more than 20,000 additional American troops to Iraq.
In Afghanistan, we and our allies prevented the Taliban from stopping a presidential election.
The elections of 2005 were a stunning achievement.
I insisted on a thorough review of our strategy.
It is clear that we need to change our strategy in Iraq.
As your commander-in-chief, I owe you a mission that is clearly defined.
Our troops will have a well-defined mission.
30,000 U.S. troops.
20,000 additional American troops.
Presidential election.
The elections of 2005.
Strategy. Clearly defined.
Well-defined mission.
Well, it's the Savage Nation, and it's a sad day indeed when we have a president who doesn't use the word win or victory, which has been said over and over again. But let's put that aside. The whole speech itself made no sense. Both left and right know it, both the left because they're anti-war, in any case. I don't know of a war that they would agree with. And the right because they don't want to die in another foreign war for reasons that are rather obtuse. The fact of the matter is, if he's going to get all the troops in, let's take it on the face value, 30,000 troops in 6 months. But he'll begin the transfer of our troops out in July of 11. So that means he's going to leave 1 year only for the fighting. Did you hear what I just said? So let's do the math together. It's going to take 6 months to get them in, and 12 months later he's going to take them out. So why would you assume that in 1 year he is going to be able to do what the American military has not been able to do in the last 8 years. How is that possible? Does he really expect to do this in 1 year, what the troops have not been able to do in more than 8 years? So that's confusing. Then he says that conditions on the ground will dictate the transition okay? So if conditions on the ground are going to be key to whether or not he withdraws men, why is he announcing a pullout date? Why does he know what the pullout date will actually be? And again, the actual strategy is transferring the fighting to the Afghani military. Do you actually believe that that's true? I don't. Do you think that that's a timeline that is realistic? Do you really think that young Afghanis are going to line up to join the U.S. military and the police, knowing that we're going to abandon them in mid-2011? If you were an Afghani and you were surrounded by murderers like this who will kill your whole family and burn your village to the ground, would you join the army or would you continue to do what you were doing and just pray to God you don't get caught up in the meat grinder? So the fact of the matter is this was a none strategy. This was a president who was involved with himself. This was a president who failed. This was a president who did not even look good. But again, this is not about criticizing Obama so much as it is simply saying it was sad to watch this. It was sad to watch this because I don't see any outcome other than what we've seen before going back to Vietnam. And I must tell you that we did our research, and not only was Obama's speech reminiscent of Bush's in 07, but it was reminiscent, moreover, of LBJ's in 1968. And I have to tell you, this is amazing sound that you're about to hear. Johnson addressed the nation on March 31st, 1968. He announced an exit strategy for Vietnam, and he said that he was unable to be reelected president because of the war. In other words, he knew it was over. He got into a quagmire and he wanted to get out of there. And here's what Johnson said. And I'm going to compare now the clip 25 and 26, Obama Johnson.
So tonight, I want the Afghan people to understand. America seeks an end to this era of war and suffering.
Let men everywhere know, however, that a strong and a confident and a vigilant America stands ready tonight to seek an honorable peace.
Well, it all sounded good, but there was no honorable peace. You were facing an enemy that was committed to killing as many as they had to kill. And remember, once America pulled out of Vietnam because of Walter Cronkite and the left-wing peace movement, over 1 million South Vietnamese were slaughtered. That's something that you're not going to see tonight on the Katie Couric News. So let me tell you something. There are consequences to us going in half measures. There are consequences to withdrawing too soon. There are consequences in terms of human dimensions that none of us can really comprehend. I want to remind you again, if you want to go back to the war that everyone knows had a validity to it, and that was World War II, that even after the Germans were defeated, after Hitler killed himself and Berlin had been smashed to rubble, you know, by the way, just as a side note, 400,000 Soviet troops died in the taking of Berlin in the last months of the war. Do you know that? So don't assume that war is not costly. In other words, even though Hitler was defeated, even though the German military had been destroyed, long after the German Air Force had been destroyed, it took 400,000 German troops to fight through the rubble of Berlin to kill the last holdouts of Nazi Germany. 400,000 German troops were sacrificed, Russian troops were sacrificed in the war that was known as the last days of the War of Berlin. 400,000 Russians died in the last days because the Germans fought to the last man. They were using young boys and old men. And by the way, the Afghanis are using young boys and old men. And they're just as fanatical, only they're even tougher. And they think that they have God on their side. On top of it all, they are fighting in a geography with which they are quite familiar. I still have to repeat that they have geography on their side, they have time on their side, they have demographics on their side. And that's why I have to say I was very saddened to watch the speech. I wasn't sitting here gloating, and I wasn't saying, oh, what an idiot. I don't react that way to a man who's in this quagmire himself. You know, Obama is in a quagmire. He didn't know what to do. He didn't know what to say. He didn't know how to appease his base and how to appease the other side as well. His entire speech was all about the 2010 elections. His entire speech and calculations were about whether or not he could hold on to enough seats in Congress in 2010 to continue pushing his radical agenda. And the bigger prize for him would be to get reelected in 2012. And don't think he's not thinking about it. They all do. From the day they're elected, they're running for the next, they're in the next campaign mode. It's just the system that we have. It's pretty screwed up, frankly. So, having said all of that, it's easy for we the people to sit here and jeer the leadership. And that's part of a national sport. We all do it. But the question falls upon my shoulders to say, what would I do? I'm obligated to tell you what I would do. I've given you strong opinions on so many things over the years. When it comes to illegal aliens, I say close the borders. I've said demand that Mexico pay us one barrel of oil per illegal. I've said that in my last several books. We're eating the social costs of the illegal aliens. And I've said for years, and in fact in my book a couple of books ago, that Mexico, which is rolling in oil, should be forced to pay us in the form of one barrel of oil per month per illegal alien. That's, what, 10, 15 million barrels of oil a month? That would help us, but we've never demanded that. I've also said Iraq should be forced to pay reparations for their liberation in the form of oil. That's never happened. I mean, there are some rational ideas that I have had over the years. Give me that. Don't assume I'm just sitting here for effect and saying things. I think I have some good ideas. So now it comes down to the Afghani strategy. You're going to ask me, if I were an armchair general or if I were called in, because they say, Savage, you know, we've listened to you on the radio. We think you're just so damn smart. We'd like you to come into the War Council and sit in with the Pentagon. Give us your ideas. What would those ideas be? Guess what? I don't have any. Do you? I'll be right back.
Savage.
See firsthand the terrible wages of war. If I did not think that the security of the United States and the safety of the American people were at stake in Afghanistan, I would gladly order every single one of our troops home tomorrow. So no, I do not make this decision lightly. I make this decision because I am convinced that our security is at stake in Afghanistan and Pakistan.
All right, let's stop right here. Now, I don't know whether to believe that. Do you believe our security is at stake in Afghanistan and Pakistan? Do you actually believe that? How do we know that's true? Why are we in Afghanistan? Now, what I see here is a politician who's gotten very far on very, very good rhetorical skills and fairly smooth operational skills, who became a president in his mind almost by accident. It reminds me of Peter Sellers in the Gardener. And in the beginning, he actually looked like he was play-acting at president. You saw how uncomfortable he looked going up the steps in Air Force One. He would look back as if to say, holy God, look what we pulled off. We all saw that. Then there were the issues of Obama bopping up to the podium in a sort of cockiness that we had never seen before. None of it made sense. And we could look at these stylistic concerns and talk about them and saying, holy God, what's going on here? But now you saw something else. Now you saw a guy who's intelligent, and inside he knows this is really deadly serious. He knows that men are going to die from this decision. This is not about scamming money for his supporters. This is not about making a bunch of fat bankers in New York happy. This is not about any of that for him now. Now it's about going along with the program, with the people who put him in power, what they want, but reluctantly. You could hear them reluctantly. You could see them reluctantly. And you could see a man racked with doubt. Now, if I could see that, so can the enemy. What do you think? Because they live in caves or they wear dirty nightshirts, they're blind and they're stupid? They have been at war for hundreds and hundreds of years. They are steeped in warfare. Their boys are trained not to put condoms on cucumbers. Their boys are trained not to be polite. Their boys are trained not to be gentlemen. Their boys are not trained to be pocketbook carriers. Their boys are not trained to be accoutrements to sluts. Their boys are trained to kill. You think they're stupid? Because they don't look like you, you're mistaken. They're not stupid. They're very smart. And so if we the people can read this reluctance, this weakness, this hesitance, and this almost, we'll go in, then we'll pull out. We'll go in 6 months and get out in a year and 6 months. And in a year, we're going to do what we couldn't do in 8 years. What do you think they're going to do with this kind of half-baked plan? What would you do if you were them? And then the other questions arise. What about Pakistan? What about Africa? What about the Philippines? What about all the other areas where the enemies of our way of life have gathered? And if you were an Afghani, an 18 to 22-year-old Afghani, would you join the police or military, knowing what's going to happen to your family when the American patrons leave the country? You don't have to be a genius to figure out what will happen to them and their family, do you? Look what happened in Vietnam when we left. The guys in South Vietnam were willing to step up to the plate and Vietnamize the war. They were killed. Their families were driven into concentration camps. 1 million South Vietnamese were killed because of Walter Cronkite and the radical left, pot-smoking, red-diaper, dopa baby vermin, who are now running this country. And so they're doing it again. Now listen to clip 14.
Time with Karzai's brother, the president's brother. They grow opium. Their tribe, the Popalzai, grows tons and tons and tons of opium. And I said to the president's brother, can you get your own people to stop growing opium? He went, no, are you crazy? He said, I'd be finished if I did. He said, one thing at a time, security first, opium second.
All right, so here is a guy, Michael Ware, on CNN, who actually for the first time in years made sense because he had been there and he talked to them. And it was amazing to me that he actually brought it up. Listen to clip 16.
Look at 16. This, mate. Look at this. This border region, this is the end of the Himalayas. These valleys swallow infantry divisions whole. How on earth do you ever expect anyone, let alone the Afghans, even the American military, to see all that? It's just not going to happen.
And now, of course, listen to clip 17 to show you what America is really interested in.
Hey, it's Tiger. I need you to do me a huge favor. Can you please take your name off your phone? My wife went through my phone and may be calling you. So if you can, please take your name off that. And you got to do this for me. Huge, quickly. All right, bye.
That's what America cares about. They care about Tiger Woods and his shenanigans. Now, do you think they really care about Afghanistan? I don't think the average American knows about Afghanistan. I think the average American cares about Tiger Woods and his mistresses and his blonde bimbo wife smashing in the window of his car and all of the jokes that I told and others told. You know, that's the fodder of America, the silly nation that we all live in. But Afghanistan is not a silly place. They don't tell jokes in Afghanistan. They kill in Afghanistan. It's that kind of place. Take the worst neighborhood you can imagine in America. I want you to think of a gang-ridden neighborhood in America where people kill each other for no reason. Richmond, California comes to mind, where it's dangerous for police to drive around in a police cruiser. Take another one. Take the worst neighborhood in your town where police are reluctant to drive through the neighborhood. They really need an Abrams personnel carrier. Now take that neighborhood, the worst neighborhood in your town, and put that neighborhood in a mountainous area and multiply the number of people who are in the gangs by a large factor. And you have an idea what we're sending these beautiful, clean-cut, intelligent 4.0 kids into. And for what? Tell me for what.
Savage.
This effort must be based on performance. The days of providing a blank check are over. President Karzai's inauguration speech sent the right message about moving in a new direction. And going forward, we will be clear about what we expect from those who receive our assistance. We'll support Afghan ministries, governors, and local leaders that combat corruption and deliver for the people. We expect those who are ineffective or corrupt to be held accountable.
Look, I lived in Kandahar. Every time I went to see the police chief, his guards would have red palms. And that's from they've just been smacking and shaping the last hashish batch. It's the whole currency of it's the oxygen that fuels or allows the economy to breathe.
Well, we didn't hear anything about hashish in last night's speech, but we heard it on CNN, which frankly was illuminating in many ways. I mean, this guy, Michael Ware, is a vehement anti-war guy, and I've taken umbrage with many of the things he's done over the years, but I was impressed with him last night because he's been there. Now, you know, look up the Khyber Pass sometime. See what the Khyber Pass is. It's a mountain pass that links Pakistan and Afghanistan. It is a linchpin on the trade route between Central Asia and South Asia, and it's a strategic military location. And what does it have to do with any of this? I don't know, maybe everything. Why is India not involved in this discussion is what I'd like to know. India has, last I checked, the fourth largest military on Earth. Why is there no discussion of India with regard to this Afghani problem? Now, the British invaded Afghanistan, just so you know, from India. The British invaded Afghanistan through India, and they fought three Afghan wars. Three, 1839 to 42, 1878 to 1880, and in 1919. And George Molesworth was a member of the British force of 1919, and here's what he said. I won't bore you with history. He said, "Every stone in the Khyber has been soaked in blood." Rudyard Kipling called it a sword cut through the mountains. And so, therefore, here we are involved with clans and tribes and chiefs, and we're going backwards rather than forward. And I'd like to know how in the world we're going to win in a hand-to-hand combat situation when they control the geography, they know the geography, and we can't use our heavy weapons. We can't use our airplanes to any extent that I can figure out as an amateur. I'm looking in as an outsider, as an amateur. I'm not a war guy, but I have common sense. And common sense sometimes is as good as anything when it comes to many businesses, and military in some ways is very much like a business. How are you going to defeat your enemy if you can't use your strongest cards? Whether you're in the stationary business or in war. In many ways, it's about strategy, innovation, and bringing all of your powers to the table. So if we're going to send our men in and not bring all of our powers to the table, that is the Air Force, that is the Navy, that is the cruise missiles, and we're going to go back to fighting a hand-to-hand combat situation, meaning we're going to take these boys from the 21st century and put them into war, a war situation with guys who are living in the 15th or 14th century, men who are steeped in killing and murder and throat cutting and torture and mayhem. They take pleasure in seeing people scream. You see, they don't bring men to Kabul for justice. They catch one of your boys. They don't call up television and tell them we're going to bring him to justice in Kabul or Karachi or in Pashtun, a town in the Pashtun. What they do is they gather around and torture him. They torture him in a way that only psychotics would even torture an animal in this country, because that's part of their culture. There's no humanity there. There's no humanism there. There's no concept of humanism there. And so the only way to deal with them militarily is to kill them. How are you going to kill them? We're asking ourselves the question. Well, where are they? You must know where they are. There must be training camps in certain regions that are in our CIA's overhead satellites. They can see them on the overhead flights, can't they? Now, let's go back in history a little bit. I had a guest on this show a number of years ago who claims he was a CIA. He was a CIA counter he was a guy in the CIA who was on the Osama bin Laden trail. Beowulf, what was his name? Do you remember? Michael Scheuer, worked for the CIA. He claimed on this show that when he worked in the CIA for Bush, they had Osama bin Laden in their sights several times, and Bush said, don't shoot. He told us that during, it was Clinton, as a matter of fact, as well, they were going to kill Osama bin Laden. They had him in their sights. They had him in their cameras. But they were told not to do it because the military did not want the collateral damage. They knew the guy was 6 foot six or whatever. He was in white robes. They had him. He was on a hunting party. But because I think one of the Saudi royal family princes went out to hunt with him, they didn't want to shoot the cruise missile. So you talk about lost opportunities. Do you think we're ever going to get those opportunities again? I don't know. Maybe Obama has a lucky star over his head. It's possible. But the fact of the matter is we the people feel lost today in a way. We knew that Obama was a radical leftist. We knew he was a socialist. But even socialists make war. In fact, socialists are very good killers. If you look at the history of the world, don't assume socialists are pacifists. There's one. Don't make that mistake. That's like assuming all Buddhists are peaceful. I told you that last week. Don't generalize. Socialists make very good killers. Look at Hitler, National Socialism. Look at Stalin and the United Soviet USSR. So don't assume socialists are not murderers. They can be if they need to be. But on the other hand, some socialists are pacifists. So what was Obama last night? What type of socialist was he? I don't know. It was as though we had Neville Chamberlain running America. Very much a Neville Chamberlain-like half-measure speech. I'm going to bring troops in. It's going to start in 6 months. And exactly a year later, I'm going to pull them out. And exactly this year, we're going to Afghanize the war. Same stuff that we heard under Johnson. We were going to Vietnamize the war. They were going to learn how to build up their military and police, and then we would be able to get out. It didn't work because the enemy didn't let it happen. They blew up police stations. They kidnapped the families of soldiers. You know, and I know, what's coming. And that's why I was saddened last night. There's no jokes today. You can't really sit here and tell jokes. It was a very sad night. It was sad in many ways. One, because I saw a president who was trapped. The man was in a corner. I mean, the man looked cornered. He didn't know which way to turn. And his instincts were to pull out and just do the anti-war thing, and he couldn't. He was no longer a candidate. He was no longer a college teacher shooting his mouth off on marijuana with his buddies, his left-wing buddies, saying, war sucks, man. Let's just get the heck out of there. No, it was no longer suddenly 1968. Now he's the president. However he got there, whoever was behind him, now he's there. Now he's got to give a speech that the world is listening to. And he knows that a lot of young kids are going to die. And he knows it. And he knows it's now falling on him. It can no longer be called George Bush's war. It is Obama's war. And now suddenly he's facing the reality of the presidency. And we the people, particularly those of you listening who have husbands, brothers, fathers, sons in or about to go in to this meat grinder, we're all asking, what are the rules of engagement, President Obama? Are you going to take the handcuffs off them? Are you going to let them fight to win to begin with? Are you going to use air power? Are you going to unleash the most powerful military on earth? Or are you going to do what they did in Vietnam and we're going to face the same end? These are the questions that are circulating in America today. Make no mistake about it. Now, I could continue to play the Obama speech and compare him to Bush and LBJ, and that's all fun and games. But, you know, if this country hasn't learned from its greatest military defeat, which was Vietnam, and believe me, I don't think it has. I think Gates is a repeat of McNamara. I think that Obama has become LBJ, and I think that we the people are the same exact dumbfounded people that were standing here in America in the mid-60s through the early 70s. It's history repeating itself, and it doesn't end well. If the greatest power on earth militarily cannot unleash its power, then it shouldn't go to war. That's my opinion. I have no other way to put it. You cannot do this halfway. It can't be done by half measure. Either you go to war or you don't go to war. Either you go to war to win or you don't go to war. To me, I'm an extremist in that regard. I don't know whether you agree with me, but that's how I see it. And moreover, what are we fighting for? Now, Obama says that we're fighting because it's the center of worldwide terrorism. I don't know whether to believe that either. Do you believe that? Listen to clip one, just a piece of it.
I see firsthand the terrible wages of war.
If I did not think that the security of the United States and the safety of the American people were at stake in Afghanistan, I would gladly order every single one of our troops home tomorrow. So no, I do not make this decision lightly. I make this decision because I am convinced that our security is at stake in Afghanistan and Pakistan. This is the epicenter of violent extremism practiced by Al-Qaeda. It is from here that we were attacked on 9/11, and it is from here that new attacks are being plotted as I speak.
So the radical left in America that was anti-war when Bush was in power, rioting, burning things, breaking windows, is rather silent in America today because they're all hypocrites. They were never anti-war. They were anti-Republican. Some of them are diehards, and they'll be out in the streets. That is true. But what's most shameful, actually, is the American leftist media. You know, when I watched guys like Wolf Blitzer, a lifetime putz, in my opinion, a lifetime puppet. I mean, I have no words that will describe my contempt for men like him and the others in the media who were so knee-jerk, anti-military when Bush was in power, to suddenly, you know, walk in lockstep and say that the war plan that Obama has makes sense. It was sickening to listen to this in the media and to see the red diaper dopa baby sluts. I can name a few of them, but I won't. The lowest of the low, the Larry Davids in skirts, suddenly becoming experts on war and saying that the president made sense. You know, it's sickening. It's saddening. I'll be right back.
Savage.
In the end, our security and leadership does not come solely from the strength of our arms. It derives from our people.
The ultimate strength of our country and our cause will lie not in powerful weapons or infinite resources or boundless wealth, but will lie in the unity of our people.
Well, that was Lyndon Baines Johnson being compared with Obama, because I've heard it before. It was very eerie. As Obama spoke, I heard Bush. But the more I listened and analyzed, I also heard Lyndon Baines Johnson. Now, I don't believe that we're going to get out in 2012, before 2012, for the election at all. I think we're building a permanent occupation. I think we're going to be there forever. And I think that we have to be somewhere, sometimes, fighting for the next 100 years, because the world has changed. The radical Islamist threat has grown. It has metastasized because it has not been met head to head. It is metastasized because liberal governments have permitted the cancer to grow. It is metastasizing because liberal governments will not say what we all know to be true. It is metastasizing precisely because of this ambivalence that we saw last night in Obama, in how he intends to half prosecute this war effort. That's my opinion. Something's wrong with this picture. You cannot win fighting a war half measure when you're fighting an enemy who fights it at one and a half measure. The enemy is ruthless. The enemy is tough. The enemy is intelligent. The enemy is battle-hardened. And the enemy is everywhere. That's my opinion. And so where does that leave us? It means, well, start with changing the rules of engagement. Now, who's going to do that? Obama? Barbara Boxer? Hillary Clinton? Russ Feingold? Who's going to change the rules of engagement? The chairman of the House Armed Services Committee, who's never fired a Daisy Beebe gun, he's going to change the rules of engagement? That sad sack with the glasses on the end of his nose? Levin, whatever his name is. I can't believe it. I wake up, I think I'm Alice in Wonderland. If you were the enemy, would you be afraid of America when you see a guy like Levin? A guy who looks right out of Dickens with a pair of glasses on the end of his nose? A lifetime red diaper doper baby? A guy who is obviously afraid of guns, a guy who's afraid of his own shadow. He is the chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee. Would you be afraid of America? If you looked at if you heard the speech of a defense secretary who said, I'm not even going to go there after Nidal executed so many soldiers at Fort Hood, when our defense secretary, when someone asked him was it jihad, and our defense secretary said, I'm not even going to go there? Would you? Would you fear this country when you know they're afraid to even say what they know is true? They may say it to each other behind closed doors. I don't know what they say. Suddenly it sounds like Obama got religion. He said it last night. He said he'd pull the troops out but he knows that's the center of terrorism in the world. And it's a threat to our existence. That seems rather odd for a man who wouldn't acknowledge that the day before. All of a sudden, he said he'd pull the troops out if he had that option, but Afghanistan and Pakistan are forefronts of terror, and so he has no choice. I didn't hear that during the campaign. Did you hear him say that during the campaign, that things are so serious? So if things are so serious, that the enemy is so strong and it's coalesced in Afghanistan, then how do you fight him? Well, I'm not in the military. I'm not a general. I'm not the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. I have no intelligence. I don't know where they are. But what I would assume is this. If there are enough of them to warrant 30,000 more troops, bringing the number up to 100,000, that means there's a real lot of them over there in various areas. They're no longer isolated terrorists running around with bombs in their chest, in their vest, right? It means there are training camps. It means there are whole villages of them with their wives and children and their mules. It means, in other words, that there are areas of population that are largely terrorist areas. Is that correct? Otherwise, why would we need 100,000 men in that area? So it means that they've coalesced into areas, into towns, into villages, into regions. And it means that those areas should be bombed into the Stone Age and everything killed, or else it's a futile effort. I'm sorry, but I didn't want to have to say this, but this is my opinion. You look at the history of war. Who has ever won a war by appealing to the enemy? Don't you see what goes on when an enemy is committed to killing you? Didn't you see it with Hitler? He fought till he killed himself. He said the Germans didn't deserve to live because they gave up so easily. And he enlisted young boys and old men. And 400,000 Russians, as I said, had to make the final push into Berlin. They had to fight hand-to-hand combat in the rubble. So you're facing an enemy that's willing to die for his cause. And you're going to fight him with the rules of Geneva Convention rules. When they torture people, when they capture them, they rip their skin off their living bodies if they can. They boil them in oil, whatever they have to do to intimidate the troops. And yet we capture one of the arch terrorists of the world. And the very same men behind Obama who were sending men in to die are going to give Khalid Sheikh Mohammed a civilian trial in the city of New York. So that means that the U.S. Marines are going to be sent into Afghanistan if they capture a terrorist leader who has conducted himself in the most horrendous way, the most barbaric way. They're going to bring him back to New York for a trial? They're going to bring him for civilian trials to appease the ACLU and the radical left that is whispering in Obama's ear? The whole thing is crazy. The whole thing is nuts. If we're really facing this existential problem of survival, as Obama claims we are, it's either live or die, sink or swim, either you're with us or you're against us, then he better say it. And he better say what he's going to do to defeat them. I didn't hear a word of it last night. How is he going to win? All he said was he's ordering 30,000 more troops. He didn't say what he's going to do with them. He's going to train the Afghanis to take over the military escapade? That didn't work in Vietnam. In fact, when Walter Crankenhaus and the radical left in America drove the American troops out of Vietnam, over 1 million Vietnamese were killed. The very Vietnamese who were encouraged to join the Vietnam military and the Vietnam police. My friends, suddenly it's 1965. So conclude with that one, will you please? Because everything that goes around comes around.
Savage.
Warning, The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now,
America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Well, everyone's talking about Obama's speech today, one way or the other. It was a failure. Nobody's happy with it. Why? Because he compromised. The fact of the matter is he had no commitment, never said victory, never said win, told the enemy when he intends to leave. The whole thing was wrong. Now, some have said that his speech sounds very eerily like Lyndon Baines Johnson's address to the nation on the night of March 31st, 1968. Both Obama and Johnson said that they would end the war, not win it. The word win the war is not spoken in either speech, and the word victory was not mentioned in Obama's. Obama said, "Tonight I want the Afghan people to understand America seeks an end to this era of war and suffering." Is that original? Johnson said, "Let men everywhere know that a stronger, confident, and a vigilant America stands ready tonight to seek an honorable peace." Oh, really? Obama said, although a legitimate government was elected by the Afghan people, it's been hampered by corruption. He then said that Karzai's inauguration speech sent the right message about moving in a new direction. LBJ said, President Tu told his people last week that a major national effort is required to root out corruption and incompetence at all levels of government. We applaud this evidence of determination on the part of South Vietnam. Our first priority will be to support their efforts. Both LBJ and Obama then sympathized with the people suffering and praised their resistance to tyranny. Obama last night said, "The people of Afghanistan have endured violence for decades. They've been confronted with occupation by the Soviet Union and then by foreign al-Qaeda fighters who used Afghan land for their own purposes." What did LBJ say? He said, now this was about Vietnam, "That small beleaguered nation has suffered terrible punishment for more than 20 years. I pay tribute once again tonight to the great courage and endurance of its people. Its people maintain their firm determination to be free of domination by the North." You hear this? And then both presidents, Johnson and now Obama, committed to friendship, not imperialistic domination. Obama said, "We will seek a partnership with Afghanistan grounded in mutual respect to hasten the day when our troops will leave and to forge a lasting friendship in which America is your partner and never your patron." What did Johnson say? "Over time, a wider framework of peace and security in Southeast Asia may become possible. Certainly, friendship with the nations of such a Southeast Asia is what the United States seeks, and that is all that the United States seeks." Both Obama and Johnson talked about the U.S.'s greatest strength, which was the American people, not the strength of the U.S. military. Obama said, "In the end, our security and leadership does not come solely from the strength of our arms. It derives from our people." What did Johnson say? "The ultimate strength of our country and our cause will lie not in powerful weapons or infinite resources or boundless wealth, but will lie in the unity of our people." Now, both presidents said that the nations America was fighting a war for must, in the end, defend their own liberties themselves. Obama said, "We'll continue to advise and assist Afghanistan security forces to assist... We'll continue to advise and assist Afghanistan security forces to ensure that they can succeed over the long haul. But it will be clear to the Afghan government, and more importantly to the Afghan people, that they will ultimately be responsible for their own country." Johnson said a similar thing about South Vietnam. There's no point in my repeating it. The question to you, the audience, tonight has been, are these parallels between Obama and LBJ an omen of the disastrous end result in Vietnam, America losing the war? Do you think that that's going to repeat itself in Afghanistan? Strategically, I don't know how we can win there. Where's the enemy? Who is the enemy? Who is the enemy in Afghanistan? First, let's define terms. We knew who the enemy was when the men were fighting against the Germans. Let's start with the obvious. It was the fascist Nazi party. They were on a quest to rule the world and impose the Nazi ideology throughout the world. So when the men were fighting, although they were scared to death like every man who fights in war is, at least they knew what they were fighting for and who the enemy was. Can you say with any certainty that you know who the enemy is in Afghanistan and why we're fighting there? I don't know who the enemy is. There are 95,000 Afghan troops at present. The U.S. wants that number up to 134. It's Vietnam all over again. I mean, it's LBJ's Vietnam syndrome all over again. We may as well have McNamara running the Defense Department because there's so much money involved. You don't understand this. Defense secretaries are not warriors, by and large. They're businessmen. They're lobbyists for defense contractors. Do you have any idea what kind of money is made on war? Have you any idea what kind of money is made on contracts? Who's going to pay for this war? Am I allowed to bring up that question? Do you actually believe that our men are going to be able to train the so-called Afghan army and the Afghan police? And let me remind you, so-called ally and Afghan policeman killed four British Special Forces operatives on a rooftop. He was supposedly on their side. I'm telling you, this is bad.
Savage.
Seems the Obama administration is trying to control every aspect of our lives, from what news we hear to our own health care. We've already talked about the so-called global warming scam and the problems some people have had with the swine flu vaccine. And you think the government should be running our lives? Joining us now with an exclusive for the Savage Nation is Robert Scott Bell.
Thanks, Michael. This week, the good news is that cap and trade may be dead after some hackers broke in and saw all the scams, the emails going back and forth on the global warming cult. They finally have been revealed for the liars and cheaters and scam artists that they've always been. And just like the scam of global warming, dissident scientists have been fringed and marginalized and denied funding if they did not parrot this cult-like dogma of the global warming religion. Well, believe it or not, Michael, of course, this happens in many fields of scientific endeavor. There are institutions, there are companies, there are activist groups that make a living off of these scams. And right now, we're about to reveal something worldwide here on the Savage Nation here. What we have here is a research slush fund. You've got the AIDS community, you've got activist groups funded by Big Pharma, people making huge sums of money off of this so-called AIDS disease, or syndrome, like it should properly be called. And in fact, the funding far outweighs its relevance to human health and the threat it is to human health.
Why do you say that?
We talk about different diseases out there as far as dangers or killers. Breast cancer is number 8. AIDS is way down the list at number 17, yet AIDS, with a $1.8 billion with a B NIH budget, gets more money than anything else. The number one killer, of course, being heart disease, got less than $500 million less than the AIDS funding. And on a per-patient basis, the disparities are even greater. Last year, AIDS got about $2,400 per patient from the NIH. Breast cancer, $230. Heart disease, just $108, the number one killer. Parkinson's down at $78. This was according to John Stossel in his report. And in diabetes, which last year killed more people than AIDS and breast cancer combined, just $28 per patient. Now, where is the funding legitimacy, honesty, and integrity here? Is the AIDS industry honest? We've got something that's breaking huge here. There's a new film, a documentary film that was put out by a filmmaker, Brent Leung. It's been winning awards around the country, around the world, in fact, at these film festivals. And the AIDS activists, the pharmaceutical industry, they're up in arms. They're trying to ban this film.
What? Why?
Well, the fact is, Brent was able to interview some of the top scientists in the field of AIDS and HIV research, including, get this, including Luc Montagnier. Montagnier was the scientist credited with finding HIV. There was a lot of controversy because Bob Gallo supposedly stole it here in America. But anyway, Montagnier last year got the Nobel Prize for his discovery. And he is featured in this film at one point acknowledging something so stunning, something that I do not think the AIDS establishment wanted him ever to utter. And for the first time, you're going to hear it here on the Savage Nation.
Play the clip.
I believe HIV, we can be exposed to HIV many times without being chronically infected. Our immune system could get rid of virus within a few weeks if you have a good immune system. And this is a problem also of African people. their nutrition is not very equilibrated. They are in oxidative stress, even they are not infected with HIV.
Montagnier acknowledges that anybody with a decent immune system can clear HIV, no problem. He also acknowledges the role of oxidative stress. That antioxidant therapy, the things we've been talking about here on the Savage Nation for quite some time now, has much more relevance to not only prevention of disease, but for recovery from those suffering.
Many ways to decrease the transmission just by simple measures of nutrition, giving antioxidants, proper antioxidants, hygiene measures, fighting the other infections. So they are not spectacular, but they could, decrease very well the epidemic to the level they are in occidental countries.
Even when asked by the filmmaker, Luc Montagnier admitted that even those in Africa were actually suffering from oxidative stress due to poor nutrition, lack of adequate sanitation and hygiene. And these things have been couched in terms as if they were all pharmaceutical drug deficiency disease, whether it was AZT or whether it was these cocktail drugs, chemotherapeutic agents that in some cases have been proven to be so toxic that people now dying of AIDS are not dying of the etiology of AIDS. In other words, the disease that they consider or the symptoms they consider part of AIDS. In fact, many are dying of liver failure, which is not part of the etiology of AIDS. So this is stunning, stunning new information here breaking. In fact, we're going to have the YouTube up for the Savage Nation listeners up at the blog. We'll get that information to you shortly. But think about this. Is the AIDS industry honest? We're seeing a lot of parallels here between what we've just found out about the global warming industry and the fact that any scientist who ever questioned the global warming paradigm was fringed, marginalized, their funding was cut.
Mm-hmm.
They were absolutely refused from any participation in the funding for global warming investigation because they simply questioned the paradigm. And outside of the San Francisco Bay Area, UC Berkeley professor Peter Duesberg, one of the first scientists, youngest scientist ever elected into the National Academy of Sciences some years back, was one of the first scientists to actually question the cause of this immune deficiency, saying that it was more likely due to oxidative stress from drug use, whether it be illicit drugs or even pharmaceutical immunosuppressive drugs, or the lack of proper nutrition, the lack of sanitation, hygiene, all of these basic things that have been around. Anybody that understood even what Louis Pasteur said before he died, acknowledging the role of the terrain or the environment on health, acknowledging his contemporary Antoine Béchamp, the guy we should have been studying in medical school. So is the AIDS industry honest? There's another insider, a mainstream researcher in the AIDS community, Nancy Padan. She did a big study in 1997 where she studied 175 heterosexual couples, one partner HIV positive, one HIV negative, and monitored them for up to 6 years to see how long it would take to transmit the so-called HIV infection from one partner to the other. And they were counseled, of course, to do what they called utilizing safe sex practices, whatever. But, of course, many of them did not. They were couples. They were married in some cases. And do you know the results of this study were so stunning they had to suppress it?
Why?
The percentage of seroconversions, that is HIV negative to HIV positive of these heterosexual couples, actually turned out to be zero. No transmissions. And they basically tried to disavow acknowledgement of this study. And there's more on this. In fact, the original study published in the original notes in a phenomenal book called Fear of the Invisible by Janine Roberts. Very embarrassing to the AIDS establishment. And so what we have here now with the House of Numbers, and it's going to be released wide in January, the whole establishment of the whole AIDS establishment is nervous. They're quaking in their boots that they will be found out, just as the global warming alarmists have been found out, that behind their house of numbers. And we go back again, once again, to Luc Montagnier, Nobel Prize winner, discoverer of HIV, to hear even more.
We should push for more, a combination of measures, antioxidant by nutrition, advice and nutrition, fighting other infections, malaria, tuberculosis, parasitosis. Most children have worms. Education, of course. Very simple measure, which not very expensive, but which could do a lot.
Exactly.
we now have the reality that billions and billions of dollars have been stolen from U.S. taxpayers to fund drug and vaccine investigations for which the identifier, the guy who discovered this HIV, says, hey, we need to be looking at nutrition, water quality, antioxidants, all the basic things that anybody with a lick of sense in understanding nutrition, that without adequate nutrition, all disease becomes possible. But instead, we've gone on a witch hunt, a wild goose chase, trying to identify a way to kill a retrovirus that, in the words of Luc Montagnier, may not even be that difficult to undo just through natural means. This is stunning, breaking news right here on the Savage Nation. Those of you that want to see the full unedited interview, because this is one of the other complaints now being made by those so-called mainstream aid scientists. They're saying, well, you probably took them out of context. Well, no, the full unedited interview is now available. And Professor Montagnier actually acknowledges Anthony Fauci, the head of NIAID, the National Institute for Allergy and Infectious Diseases. And in saying, he realizes that what he's saying, you probably never heard from Fauci. All of the funding, just like we've talked about in global warming, we need to be putting some serious questions on it. We don't have enough money with a 20% unemployment rate to be spending on phantom retroviruses when we know that nutrition can counter this and many other of these illnesses plaguing Africa, much less those that don't know how to take care of themselves here on our soil that are relying on drugs instead of nutrition for their good health. So once again, if you want to learn more about this, I've got the YouTube linked up. First time ever available worldwide right here on the Savage Nation. You go to robertscottbell.blogspot.com or just Google my name. You'll find it. This is stunning information. But again, maybe now we can spend money more appropriately on diseases that really deserve it. And of course, with immune deficiency, the simplest thing we can all be doing is living healthier lifestyles. Thanks, Michael.
Thanks for the report, Robert.
Savage.
Well, we're all talking about Obama's recent speech and his plans for Afghanistan. Joining us now with his views is James Phillips with the Heritage Foundation.
Thank you, Michael. I wrote a paper along with Lisa Curtis saying that Obama's Afghanistan speech, although it was a step in the right direction in the sense that it committed 30,000 more U.S. troops to Afghanistan, it also was a step back in the sense that he called for the beginning of withdrawal in 18 months, and that led in the speech to an incredibly schizophrenic passage where he said in two sentences, it's in our vital interest to send an additional 30,000 U.S. troops to Afghanistan. After 18 months, our troops will begin to come home. And the point we made in our paper was that that's strategic schizophrenia. If it's a vital interest, there's no reason to suppose that after only 18 months, U.S. troops are going to safeguard that vital interest. So it makes no sense to promise to start withdrawing them after 18 months. In fact, that plays right into the hands of the Taliban and other Afghan insurgents, because all they have to do is wait us out.
Is this McChrystal's strategy here or what?
No, this is a major departure not only from General McChrystal's plan, but from the administration's early rollout of this, if its new comprehensive strategy last March, which turned out to be not so comprehensive. It's a real step back from that. And I think that this was, as President Obama said in the speech when he quoted Eisenhower, the president must balance interests. But here I think he's balancing his political interests. And I think what he saw as the prime threat to this policy is the restless left wing of the Democratic Party, his own party. And so he threw the timeline for withdrawal in as a way of attracting their support. And, you know, I just think that that makes the whole speech very incoherent.
Well, we haven't seen any troops yet, but we already planned the return date. How? Isn't that signaling to the enemy?
No, it's crazy, because even if they're deployed in the spring of 2010, it'll take them, several months just to get used to their surroundings. So they really won't be effectively deployed until the summer of 2010. And then to turn around and start pulling them out again in the summer of 2011, I just think that's unrealistic. And, you know, that part of the speech, I think, was crafted with more of a domestic audience in mind. And unfortunately, that could undermine the prospects for success of the whole strategy.
Well, it looks to me like Obama's trying to please both sides here. What do you think of this new strategy's chance of success?
Well, I think there is some chance of success if President Karzai gets his act together and purges the corrupt elements of his regime, and if the Pakistani government continues to take a hard line towards its own Taliban and is encouraged to go even farther and actually take action against the Afghan Taliban, because the high elements, the chief leaders of the Afghan Taliban have found sanctuary in Pakistan. And although Pakistan cooperates with the U.S. to go after al-Qaeda, it's turned a blind eye to the Afghan Taliban. And that really has to end in order for the U.S. and the Afghan government to be victorious in Afghanistan.
How do you think this should have been done?
Well, I think the whole drawn-out policy review process, which took, I think, 92 days, really could have been avoided, at least publicly. The administration could have done it in a more private fashion and then announced that it was tweaking its strategy rather than raise public expectations that it was going to announce a new strategy and then continue to disappoint the public expectations by postponing it again and again. And that led to a lot of leaks by different factions within the administration, which kind of made the process more incoherent to outside observers, and also suggested to Afghans and Pakistani that the administration was getting ready to pull the plug on Afghanistan, when in reality it was considering a troop increase the whole time. So I think a lot less public hand-wringing and kind of Hamlet-like double questioning of its own strategy would have gone far to reassure not only the American people but the Afghan and Pakistani governments that the U.S. was a reliable ally. Instead, President Obama, I think, has weakened our image as a reliable ally in that part of the world. On the plus side, I think it's, we need to recognize that he is making a hard decision given the proclivities of many within his party. And that, I think, deserves to be praised. I just wish he hadn't thrown in this kind of afterthought about the timeline for withdrawal. I think one of the problems here is that the Obama administration does not admit that we are in a war, not only a war in Afghanistan, and we're continuing to fight in Iraq, but a broader war against Islamist terrorism. And even in the speech last night, there was very little reference to the Islamist nature of these extremists. You know, there was a very politically correct definition of the Taliban and al-Qaeda as extremists, but, it wasn't clear what kind of extremists. And I think because the administration is in denial about the war we're in, it's hard for it to make the case for continued sacrifice in Afghanistan. And that showed in kind of the schizophrenic nature of the speech last night.
James Phillips, thanks again for speaking about this on The Savage Nation.
Thanks again, Michael.
I'll be right back.
Savage.
Obama's speech about Afghanistan was eerily like one that President LBJ gave in 1968. I frankly couldn't believe it when I heard it and listened to them side by side. Now listen, here's Obama talking about the president of Afghanistan.
President Karzai's inauguration speech sent the right message about moving in a new direction. And going forward, we will be clear about what we expect from those who receive our assistance. We'll support Afghan ministries, governors, and local leaders that combat corruption and deliver for the people. We expect those who are ineffective or corrupt to be held accountable.
And here's Johnson talking about the president of South Vietnam.
President Chu told his people last week that a major national effort is required to root out corruption and incompetence at all levels of government. We applaud this evidence of determination on the part of South Vietnam. Our first priority will be to support their effort.
Amazing. Here's Obama on the suffering of Afghanistan.
Now, the people of Afghanistan have endured violence for decades. They've been confronted with occupation by the Soviet Union and then by foreign al-Qaeda fighters who used Afghan land for their own purposes.
And here's LBJ on the suffering of Vietnam.
That small, beleaguered nation has suffered terrible punishment for more than 20 years. I pay tribute once again tonight to the great courage and the endurance of its people.
And Obama didn't just sound like LBJ. He sounded a lot like George Bush as he was getting us deeper into Iraq. Listen.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
I have determined that it is in our vital national interest to send an additional 30,000 U.S. troops to Afghanistan.
I've committed more than 20,000 additional American troops to Iraq.
In Afghanistan, we and our allies prevented the Taliban from stopping a presidential election.
The elections of 2005 were a stunning achievement.
I insisted on a thorough review of our strategy.
It is clear that we need to change our strategy in Iraq.
As your commander-in-chief, I owe you a mission that is clearly defined.
Our troops will have a well-defined mission.
30,000 U.S. troops.
20,000 additional American troops.
Presidential election.
The elections of 2005.
Strategy.
Strategy.
Clearly defined.
Well-defined mission.
Can you believe this? So here we are. What do you got to say? Hey, hey, ho, ho. Hey, hey, ho, ho. Hey, hey, ho, ho. Why are we in Afghanistan? What should we do with Afghanistan? Should we cut and run and let the Taliban or al-Qaeda, whatever they call them over there, we know who they are, radical Islamists, you know, why mince words, take over the country? I mean, Karzai is corrupt. He stole the election. I mean, basically, you got a terrorist running Afghanistan right now, propped up by the American government. I mean, you think I don't see it? What, am I blind? I see everything. I have the eye that sees all. I have the all-seeing eye, 360-degree eye. Karzai is corrupt. He's running Afghanistan. Who put him in? We put him in. Why? What are we there for? What the heck does Afghanistan have to do with America? Can anyone explain it to me? For the life of me, I don't know why we are there, why our men are dying. Why did 10 American Special Forces men die? Well, two were shot in the back by Afghani police who were probably Taliban. In the, you know, you would trust them if you were a soldier. You'd want your cohort from the Afghani police fighting alongside you. At night, he puts on the police uniform. You go to sleep, he shoots you in the back. The other eight were overrun on a fort that they set up on top of a hill in some horrendous tribal region. Now, why were they able to overrun the hill? Why was the enemy able to overrun the hill? Well, you didn't read this in your local paper, boys and girls. Half of the hundreds of Taliban who came screaming up the hill to kill our men came out of a mosque. That's right. The imam told them to go kill the crusaders on the hill. And why was the mosque permitted to be a haven, a safe haven for murderers and terrorists? Because of the rules of engagement. Mosques, you see, are off limits. Mosques are sacred. And although they have their weapons hidden in the mosque and they have their murderers hidden in the mosque, you can't blow it off the face of the earth because that would be too sensible if you're fighting a war. Now, although they charged up the hill, which is the reverse of any rule of sanity, they were able to win. Why were they able to win in running up a hill? You know, history of battles, if the enemy has the high ground, retreat, never charge because you're going to lose. And yet the enemy had the low ground and they charged and won. That's despite the fact that we brought in air power after the fact, not before the fact. The reason is our men have rules of engagement that are suicidal. It's no longer do not fire until you see the whites of their eyes. It's something along the lines of, well, I can't even say it on the radio. It's a family show. The enemy, though, has a different set of rules, a different set of rules of engagement. The enemy's rules, as taught to them on the battlefield and in the mosques, is kill every man that you find in the most horrible way. Charge them and kill the crusader. Kill the white devil. Kill them, and kill them. They don't care who's there with them. They don't care if there's an army nurse. They don't care who's there. They're taught one thing. Kill them, kill them, kill them. Our men are taught, oh, don't shoot. Don't blow up that mosque, even though they're charging you from the mosque, because that might look bad tomorrow on Wolfie Blitzer's show on CNN, or one of the other propagandist leftist traitors from hell who'll run a picture of a smoking mosque. So you have to make a decision as an American. The American people haven't been given the choice. Has there been a national debate? Why are we in Afghanistan? Should we be in Afghanistan? Has a poll been done on this? Has a poll been done on this? Why are we in Afghanistan? Do you give a rat's behind about Afghanistan? I don't. I see no strategic reason for holding on to Afghanistan. Yes, I understand they'll have a victory if you let them take over the country and blah, blah, blah. And then they'll feel empowered, all of that. So what? So they act up, then use the weapons that you have, for God's sakes. Stop ripping us off the military-industrial complex. Trillions of dollars. Submarines, B-2 bombers, Tomahawk missiles unused. We have our men fighting like in the 18th century, hand-to-hand combat and rifles. You hear this? Rifles! We tell them to use rifles. We have weapons that we could fire from invisible sights, from submarines hundreds of miles away. We could wipe them off the map. We don't use them. What good are they? What good are they? So as I say, if we don't have the men to lead us, why are we having men to die for us? If, on the other hand, the American people decide that it's in our national interest to be in Afghanistan, then you have to say, how do we win? You're not going to win their hearts and minds. There are no minds there. There's only hatred. There's only hatred. They hate you. They hate us. They hate our religions, and they hate our way of life. They hate our freedom. They hate our women. They hate everything about us. So you're never going to win their hearts and minds. That's a failed policy that goes back to Lyndon Baines Johnson. It failed in Vietnam. It's going to fail again here. They're not winning the hearts and minds of fanatics like this. So again, use your common sense. Use some knowledge of history. Either we cut and run or we kill them. That's all. It's as simple as that. And we kill them not using the best boys of America. We don't send our boys into a meat grinder to die into the hamburger hill in the sand. We don't send them there and say, don't shoot unless you see this. Don't fire if they're surrounded by women. Don't fire if they're in a mosque. Don't fire if they're in this and that. Are you people crazy? The enemy understands our rules of engagement, and he exploits them. Wouldn't you, if you were fighting a psychotic enemy? A psychotic enemy that won't even kill your fighters if he has his girlfriend with him, or his wife, or a boyfriend wrapped up in a woman's outfit to make it look like he's with a woman? What would you do if you were the enemy, you idiot, you? So, you know, you ask me to give you my opinion. I'm giving you one man's opinion. Should we be in Afghanistan or not? And if we shouldn't, then let's get out. If we should, three bombers from Missouri could end this conflict in a few hours. All they got to do is have a commander-in-chief who cares enough about America to launch them. And I'll tell you something else. I'll give you a little hint right now. If we had a president who was really fighting for this team called America, and not somehow, we don't know, where was he born, what side is he on, we don't know. We have real fears about this government of ours under this current regime. If we had a president who was a real commander-in-chief and he said, you know what, that's it, it's enough, we spent 9 years and some of the best and brightest have died there, I'm fed up with it, launch them. Here's the launch code, launch the bombers out of Missouri. I will tell you that 12 hours later, America would be the strongest nation on earth again. The dollar would rise. The stock market would rise. Confidence in America, both internal and external, would rise. And all of our enemies would stop acting up. All of them would go back to their holes, go back to what they know how to do best, which is hate, hate, and hate again. General McChrystal, probably a good man, and I'm an armchair general, I admit it, is saying that without more troops, we're going to lose in Afghanistan. But wait, it gets worse. You know, there's more troops in Afghanistan or we lose. He wants them to become policemen. He wants to win the hearts and minds of the Afghanis. Now, I don't know if General McChrystal is a highly educated man. I don't even know if he read the history of Afghanistan. But methinks the British tried winning the hearts and minds of the tribes in Afghanistan. And so far as I remember, the ground is littered with the blood and bones of dead Brits going back quite a long while. You don't win a war by sending troops over and telling them not to fire. Now, wait, it gets worse. the great genius general, McChrystal, I don't know who's the armchair general, him or me, has said we need more troops and we want them outside of the armored vehicles. We want boots on the ground. Now he says, admittedly, more of our men will die, but it'll make the Afghanis feel better. So if your son or daughter is in the military, get ready to hear that a body bag is on the way to you with a nice folded flag. Because that way, well, you don't offend the Afghanis that you're trying to get over on your side. The last thing you want to do is bomb them into submission, because that would be too much like war. And, of course, we're not really at war. We're just in a fake war. And in a fake war, what you do is you turn your troops into policemen and you put them at risk. The soldier on the street, he's the one that has to get shot or bombed. Take him outside of the armored vehicle and put him in the ground so the Afghanis could either capture him, shoot him, cut his legs off, cut his head off on the internet. But then they'll be a happy people. If they have more American heads to hang on their doorposts, they might actually become Americans. We might be able to open up falafel stands for them with billions of dollars in contractor aid. Or a meat stand of some kind that the Afghanis like, some type of meat that they like. And we can get a couple of contractors now who used to work for Bush, who are now Democrats, who worked for Obama, to go over there and build the falafel stands. And we'll call that war. Call that the new kind of war. Build a falafel stand on every corner with American money, another couple of $1 trillion down the toilet, and then leave in 10 years and say, whoops, made a mistake. Oops, we should have gotten out when I came in, but hey, what the heck, I'm now out of office, and there's no longer an America. It's just one little happy world now. Have a nice day. I'm now the president of the world, and don't you love how I'm loved everywhere, wherever I go?
Savage.